When I returned from sabbatical in May, there was a surprise waiting for me outside my bedroom window. A hummingbird had chosen the ficus tree on my terrace to build her nest. It was tiny and perfect, woven of sticks and lined with feathers, really soft. She must have gathered one by one. It was about the size of an egg cup. And then she laid two eggs and she settled onto them in a kind of a trance. It's called torpor, incubating them night and day. And you can imagine, hummingbirds are the fastest moving creatures. And all of a sudden, she was completely still. She barely left, except for the briefest trips for food. And I felt so protective over her that I stopped going out on my terrace just to give her privacy. And I would spy on her from my bedroom window at a distance, hardly able to wait for those chicks to hatch. And the whole thing felt like a miraculous secret, like I'd been given a front row seat to the mystery of life itself. And every time I left my apartment, I would come home excitedly to see her still sitting there, almost frozen on her nest, day after day, week after week. And then about 2 weeks into her vigil, just before the eggs were due to hatch, I came home from Chalice one Sunday to find a crow squawking viciously on my balcony right by that tree. And my stomach dropped. I went out immediately to check on the baby mama, and she was gone. And the nest had been knocked sideways, and part of a tiny egg lay shattered on the ground beneath it. In the moment she had slipped away to eat, the crow had raided her nest. I hoped that the second egg had at least survived, but I wasn't sure. The mama bird came back and lowered herself into the nest again, dutifully, maybe not yet understanding what had happened. And then the crow returned for a second pass, and I clapped and I shouted until it flew away. But inside, I felt something crack open. And a deep grief flooded in. I still feel it now. Now, I know this is simply the way things are in the natural world and that the strong prey on the vulnerable. But knowing that didn't make it hurt any less. So much mother's devotion had gone into incubating those chicks. I was so ready to watch them hatch and grow. Can you imagine tiny little hummingbirdlets? And then in an instant, it was all gone, destroyed. I wondered if a hummingbird grieves. She sat there for a while, not settling into her usual stillness, clearly unsettled and confused. And I wanted to offer her comfort. But of course, there was nothing to offer except my own grief sitting beside hers. And then after about 10 minutes, she left the nest and she never came back. And when I finally looked inside the nest, there was nothing left but a few broken shells. To be honest, I cried and I felt quite depressed for a while after that experience, and I wrote it down immediately. I'd fallen in love with the hope, the promise of that new life, and the whole process of tending and nurturing it, and in one instant it was all destroyed. And I've been thinking about that tiny bird ever since, because I think most of us know how she would have felt. That deep ache when something we loved and tended is taken before its time. And there's nothing we could have done. And of course, I don't think that ache belongs only to hummingbirds or grieving mothers. I think it belongs to all of us, as we heard just now, going through the struggles of life, watching the news, watching our country, and watching the earth itself. Now, of course, in the scheme of things, a hummingbird losing its eggs is minor compared to the families torn apart by ICE raids each week, each day. To sick people losing their medical coverage, to poor people all around the world not getting enough food to survive, as you spoke so eloquently about earlier, Barbara. To the wars grinding on in the Middle East and elsewhere. To the quiet dismantling of our national parks, our libraries and universities, our scientific and civic institutions. To the planet warming faster than we can bear to imagine. And to our helplessness in the face of so much destruction and harm. But watching that hummingbird taught me something I didn't expect. The opposite of heartbreak is not happiness. The opposite of heartbreak is indifference. It's not allowing ourselves to feel. So here's the question I've been reflecting on since. What do we do with a heart that keeps getting broken every day? Should we even try to keep it open in the middle of so much cruelty and loss? Wouldn't it just be easier to put up a wall, to stop watching the news, to go a little numb, to protect ourselves from feeling so much sorrow and pain? Now, I understand the appeal. Closing our hearts in the middle of so much pain isn't a moral failure. We don't shut down because we're bad or selfish or don't care enough. We shut down because it hurts and we're exhausted. Our nervous systems were never built to absorb 24-hour news cycles of the whole world suffering. Nobody's heart was designed to metabolize that much grief every waking hour, right? And when someone tells me I can't watch the news anymore, or I don't want to know, or simply, I'm done, I don't hear callousness. I hear someone whose heart ran out of room. Closing is what an overwhelmed heart does to survive. And tears are okay, my friends. Because I want to ask you gently, what does closing our hearts cost us? I've been listening to a conversation between the Christian mystic Cynthia Bourgeau and the Buddhist teacher Adyashanti. And something Bourgeau said has stayed with me. She calls the heart an organ of spiritual perception. Not simply where we feel things, but where we see deeply from. And it needs to be open and tender to do that. And Adyashanti describes living from the heart as a kind of belonging, an intimacy that doesn't require an object. No other person or creature is needed to complete it. The heart is about intimacy with all there is and a sense of belonging to it. It's the opposite of the mind's eye, which reinforces separation and sorts the world into us and them, friend and foe, self and other. The heart, my friends, when it's open, he says, doesn't perceive strangers, it perceives relationship. Close the heart and the world turns into objects and categories, enemies and separation. But keep it open hard as it may be, and the world stays somehow whole and interdependent. That's why I think staying open-hearted matters so much, and why I don't think it's simply the nicer or more moral choice. I think it may actually be the only way to fully feel alive. My friends, love only enters through an open heart. So does joy, wonder, gratitude, and awe. They all come in through the same door that grief comes in through. Brother David Steindl-Rast, the Benedictine monk who turned 100 years old earlier this month, whose grateful gatherings we've been doing for the last year, and who survived the Nazi occupation of Austria as a young man, put it this way. If we shut our hearts to the pain of the world, our celebrations become superficial. If we let the pain overwhelm our hope, we're lost in the dark. Tears in which pain and joy flow together do justice to life in its fullness. The heart only has one door. Shut it against the sorrow, and you shut it against the joy, too. There is no way to selectively numb. And here's another reason we shouldn't close our hearts. An open heart is what allows us compassion and allows compassion to actually move through the world. Maria Shriver wrote recently about the Norwegian men's soccer team who lost in the World Cup to England. But when they returned home, the whole country turned out for them. A very different response to than what happened when our US team lost. And they didn't turn out for a victory parade or to boo them. Instead, the Norwegians have a tradition called the Viking Row, where the crowd roars the word row and mimics the motion of pulling hard against the current together as one. And when their team came home without a trophy, Norway rowed for them anyway, as if the effort itself, the showing up and giving everything, was worth celebrating on its own terms. That is what an open heart makes possible, my friends. Not the guarantee of winning, but the willingness to keep rowing together and to celebrate one another for rowing. Our own Unitarian Universalist Association has been asking us to do something similar this year in what they're calling Meet the Moment, inviting our congregations to keep showing up and being curious in small ways and large, rather than waiting until we feel strong enough or certain enough or victorious enough to act. But they also emphasize that what got us here isn't necessarily going to get us where we need to go. So despite the difficult times we're in, we have to stay innovative, keep strong the power of hope and imagination and possibility. We don't have to save the world by ourselves, my friends. That's why we gather. We simply have to keep rowing and let others alongside row as well, and let ourselves be rowed on the days that we cannot lift an oar. And here's the third reason keeping our heart open matters, and it may be the hardest one to sit with. An open heart refuses to divide the world into saints and sinners. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who survived the Soviet gulags, wrote, "If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil, he says, cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? We can't just blame the crows of this world. We all have a little of that aggressive squawk in us. My friend Angela Findlay, who wrote about discovering that her own grandfather had been a Nazi general in her book, My Grandfather's Shadow, put it just as plainly. Human beings are capable of both extraordinary good and extreme evil. And if we accepted that as a foundational truth, our society might paradoxically become more compassionate and more honest. Instead, we are encouraged to project evil onto others and goodness onto ourselves. Now, please don't get me wrong here. This is not an argument for looking away from injustice or softening our resistance to cruelty and not holding perpetrators accountable. It's the opposite. An open heart holds both truths at once. This behavior is wrong and must be named as wrong, and the person doing it is still, underneath it, a human being capable of more than this. That double vision doesn't weaken our sense of justice. It deepens our compassion, and it keeps us from becoming the very polarized beings that we are fighting against. But how exactly do we do this? It's much easier to blame the crows of this world. First, I want to share what an open heart feels like. Because it might not be what we imagine. It's not constant cheerfulness. It's not naive, and it's not endlessly positive or spiritually bypassing. An open heart is tender. It notices beauty without being asked to. It's easily moved, cries more readily, laughs more freely. It's willing to be surprised by a stranger instead of guarding against one. It can hold grief without hardening into bitterness. It can celebrate someone else's joy without a flicker of envy. It's soft without being weak. And it is, in its own quiet way, courageous because it refuses to let fear have the final word. So how do we keep a heart open that keeps getting broken? I don't think it's a single decision we make once. I think it's a practice, something we return to daily, the way the hummingbird returned to her nest. We stay open by grieving what deserves to be grieved instead of rushing past it. We stay open by noticing one true, beautiful thing every day on purpose, because beauty is not a distraction from the world's pain. It's evidence that the pain is not the whole story. One of the practices our board and committee on shared ministry are going to undertake this year is noticing delight. We're going to read a book together for our spiritual growth called The Book of Delights by Ross Gay. And the idea is to read these short essays on things that delight, specifically to keep our spirits focused on the many beautiful, enchanting things in life that go on amidst all the heartbreak. And hopefully it will help us all be open-hearted leaders And I invite any of you who wish to join us in reading this book, if you like. Of course, we also keep our hearts open by limiting how much outrage we let ourselves consume, because a heart marinated in outrage stops being able to feel anything else. Right? We stay open by serving somewhere, however small, which is what we do here at Chalice. We stay open by singing together, by laughing, by walking outside among living things, by meditating, by hugging each other. We stay open by letting other people row for us on the days we cannot lift an oar ourselves. And we stay open by remembering again and again that we belong to one another. And of course, another way to stay open amidst heartbreak is practicing self-compassion. When you feel overwhelmed, hopeless, or heartbroken, and you want to shut down, a great antidote is to put your hand on your heart and speak to yourself as you would to a dear friend. Put your hand on your heart now and try this out. You might say something like, "I know this is hard, my love. I know your heart is hurting and you're tired and exhausted with all the cruelty, pain, and struggle in this world. But I'm here for you. I'll stay here with you through this. I love you, and I will be by your side through the difficult times. We're in this together." Sharing kind, loving words like that with ourselves, as we would with friends, acknowledging our grief and pain, can help us stay open in the midst of heartbreak. And one more way to stay open is to look for all that's still good and going, getting even better in the world. To focus on the vision of the future that gives us hope. At our staff meeting this week, our wise administrator, Anna, hi Anna, said something that stayed with me. She reminded me that there is still really good things happening in the world, worth hoping and working for. Solar panels small enough for an apartment balcony. Car batteries that can go 1,000 miles on one charge. A company that gives back by planting 1,000 trees a day. She wasn't asking us to look away from what's broken. She was asking us to notice that the tipping point towards good is also here. It's also here quietly, alongside everything else. That isn't optimism. Optimism says everything's going to work out fine, and as we know, often it doesn't. Hope is different. Hope says something beautiful is still worth working towards, whether or not we live to see it finished. And that distinction matters. Our faith is built on hope, an active hope, not on any kind of guarantees. So, my beloveds, I don't know whether another hummingbird will build a nest in that ficus tree next spring. I hope she does. Because despite everything, hummingbirds keep building nests and laying eggs. And trees keep putting out new leaves. Flowers keep blossoming. Lotus blossoms keep growing out of the mud. People keep falling in love even after their hearts have been broken. Children keep being born into a world that will likely be challenging. And people keep showing up for each other. Congregations keep singing. And we keep lighting this chalice week after week, an old light made new again each time. We keep rowing together my friends. And that is what an open heart does. It keeps risking love even after love has broken it, especially after love has broken it. Because that is the price for being alive. And what a glorious life it is for the time we have here together. My friends, may we have the courage to keep our hearts open. And when they close, because they will, to find the compassion, hope, and tenderness to gradually open them again. Because being open-hearted despite everything is what will save our world. May it be so. Amen. And let me tell you, I had to preach this sermon because I wrestle with this every day. And I'm sure I'm not alone.